Good afternoon, and thank you for tuning in to Faith and Reason. As your host, Dr. John Pinero, and for the next hour, we're going to be talking about one of my favorite historians of the 20th century, and is someone who figures prominently in a class I teach at Aquinas College here in Grand Rapids, and that is Christopher Dawson, the English Catholic historian. And who better to talk about Dawson with than the man who literally wrote the book about Dawson? We might hope there would be more books on Dawson, but perhaps this our guest today can explain why there's not. So we're going to be talking to Dr. Bradley Berzer, who authored a book a few years back called Sanctifying the World, The Augustinian Life and Mind of Christopher Dawson. And really is a fabulous book. I would recommend those of you listening, which I hope is quite a few people today, that you would go out and get that book and take a look at it. But better yet, I think, as we'll talk about over the course of this hour, go out and read some Christopher Dawson. I think we'll get some good recommendations from Dr. Berzer. Dr. Berzer is professor of history and Russell Amos Kirk Chair in American Studies at Hillsdale College, where he has served on the faculty since 1999. Dr. Berzer earned his Ph.D. in history from Indiana University and is also the author of American Cicero, Charles Carroll of Carrollton, as well as J.R.R. Tolkien's Sanctifying Myth, Understanding Middle-Earth. And he does have a new book in the works on Russell Kirk that should be out hopefully sometime later this year. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks, John. It's great to be here. I really appreciate you asking me.
Oh, it's a pleasure to have you. Earlier this summer, Brad Berzer and I were both at Acton University here in downtown Grand Rapids, and I had a chance to, Brad, listen to you talk about Christopher Dawson and really enjoyed that lecture. I mean, it was great to see the Acton Institute expand its offerings to things outside the realm of economics, but much more into culture this year, and I appreciated that. And it was great to see you on the bill this year.
Yeah, thanks, John. I've done stuff with Acton off and on since the early 1990s, so this was the first time they've asked me to speak for them, so that was a great honor, and I was overwhelmed by how many people were at that conference. I was not expecting that, but well over 1,000 people there.
Yeah,
so that was pretty astounding.
Yeah, I think that was probably the biggest yet. Well, let's talk about Dawson, and I think a good place to start is if you could just tell us who Christopher Dawson was, just maybe a brief sketch of his life.
Sure, John. Christopher Dawson was an Anglo-Welsh scholar, so his mother's side was Welsh, his father's side was from Yorkshire, and he was born in 1889 and he died in 1970. For most of his career, he was a freelance scholar, and he came from aristocracy, but not from money. So, you know, he inherited a lot, but didn't really have the ability to pay for much of it, but was able to maintain kind of the most basic aristocratic lifestyle, and really did spend most of his time just researching and writing. He converted to Catholicism, very happily converted to Catholicism, though there were problems with his family over it. He converted intellectually and spiritually in 1913, but then actually came into the church formally in January on Epiphany of 1914. He had assented in 1913, converted in 1914. And then he really only had one major academic position, and that was a five-year chair he was given at Harvard, which he only served four of those years. This would have been 1958 to 1962, because he had gone into poor health. A series of strokes had rendered him dumb and had really limited his own abilities. So he had to forgo that final fifth year of that chair and went back to England, basically spent the rest of his life just kind of in and out of comas, and then passed away. Mm. But during his own lifetime, when he was writing in pre the stroke, so pre-1962, he produced an outrageous number of books. I mean, when you think about how much he was producing in terms not only of articles, but public lectures, speeches, and then just books themselves, really an astounding career in all kinds of ways. Largely forgotten now, I'm sure we'll talk about that, largely forgotten, but in his own day and age, everybody took him seriously, even those who didn't come from the same religious background.
And when you say everybody, is this primarily the United States, or was he well-received in England as a Catholic writer?
He was, you know, it depends. depends at what time period we're looking, John, but certainly in the English-speaking world throughout his entire career, he was well-known. So you have all kinds of figures here in America, like Reinhold Niebuhr, but then you also have people abroad in his own country of England, like Aldous Huxley. Everywhere, people are really taking his stuff seriously, even if they disagree with him, like Huxley did on a number of religious issues, as you might imagine. But they ran in some of the same circles, argued with one another. T.S. Eliot, of course, was probably his most famous, I hesitate to call him disciple, but certainly ally. And then he was also very prominent prior to World War II. So between the two wars, he was a very prominent Christian humanist throughout all of Catholic Europe, and even into some of the Orthodox countries as well, especially with the exiles from Russia, like Nicholas Berdyaev. He was well known. So he ran in that kind of humanist circle and had served as an editor, had brought a number of people like Maritain into the English-speaking world, not solely, of course, but as a part of it, and really did a lot, I think, as an editor as well as a writer to kind of create a Catholic republic of letters.
Well, when you mention the Eliot and some of these very famous people, it just leads me to wonder whether the average person also would have read Dawson. I read a book long ago. It was Blue Collar Intellectuals by Flynn, published through ISI. And he was talking about what he argues in that book, was a bygone era prior to the 1960s, where a lot of people in America, for instance, working class people, blue collar people, read really good books about great books or great books themselves. And I guess this particular book I'm thinking of, Blue Collar Intellectuals, was a bit of lament that that's not the case anymore. So I guess I'm wondering about the average folks. Are they lay Catholics and others? They're reading Dawson too at this time.
Yeah, they were, John. And I'm not familiar with that book. It sounds like something I need to check out. It sounds really good. But there was, you know, as we know, in America especially, but also in Britain, there was that whole, and I hesitate in America to call them a class of people because our classes were so fluid and have been for most of our history. But there was definitely a group of what we might call intellectual working class people in America from, you know, roughly the 1870s all the way up into the 1960s. I can think of someone, you know, like very prominent, at least in the conservative movement, like Annette Kirk, who came out of that in New York from a very, her father was an artist, but they were working class, and yet it was expected that she would read her Epictetus. It was just expected in high school that if you're a serious person, you read the classics. And I think that has been lost in all kinds of ways. But to get to your question about where Dawson fit into that, Dawson actually didn't care if he was read among the intellectuals generally. He wanted to bring, I think, the level of intellectual discourse to everybody. And part of his own project during his life, and one reason he didn't want an academic position because he didn't want to get trapped in academic writing.
Good man.
He wanted to be able to, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I just said good man. That's good.
Yeah,
good for him.
Right. Yeah. Right. So you know, he wanted to be able to write, as he said, to the kind of people who read all the time, but read intelligent magazines and newspapers so that he would have access to them as well as to scholars. But I think he was such a good writer and such a good researcher that, my 3-year-old just walked in, that I think he did appeal to both scholars as well as to average people who, at the end of their working day, they came home and rather than watching TV, they were able to read.
That's, you know, it's very interesting that you describe that, because that's the toughest balance, I think, for me as an academic and a writer, too, trying to think of how to combine those audiences. I mean, you want to affect what's going on among the self-proclaimed intellectuals or really the academics. But on the other hand, you don't want to just have 5 people talking to each other. Right. You want to affect the culture broadly,
absolutely.
Too.
Yeah, absolutely, John. And you know, we know how easy it is with specialization to just have kind of in-think and group-think.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of that in academia, and it's terrible. It's not good for academia. It's not good for anyone outside of academia either.
So somebody like Dawson, you talk about his amazing output, and it really, I don't know the exact number of books. Maybe you can tell us in a second here, but it's a tremendous number. I've not read all of Dawson. And what accounts for being so prolific, especially a man like Dawson, whom, as we know, suffered bouts of depression, and later on in life, his last 10 years, it sounds like he couldn't have written much because of his strokes.
Right. He really didn't know this until I went through his papers. This daughter, in her biography of her father, does not really mention he suffered very seriously from manic depression, really seriously. Paranoia, he suffered from insomnia. So, but that wasn't always. I don't understand manic depression that well psychologically, but my understanding is that, you know, when you're in the manic phase, nothing can stop you. And yet when you're in the depressive phase, nothing can really get you out of it. And that seems to be the case with Dawson. If you just look at when he was writing articles and books, there's just a stream of them coming out, just one after another. And they're so good and so insightful and so well done, and, you know, just basically in terms of grammar and style, just perfect. And then you'll have long periods where there's absolutely nothing from him. And that didn't really make sense to me until I started reading correspondence between Dawson and Frank Sheed, the great publisher of his day, and Dawson and others, and Sheed and others, and realizing, wow, this guy is really, really suffering psychologically.
That's tough. Is he the tortured genius type? I mean, does he fit in that type of writer?
Yeah, you know,
my
sense is, and again, I'm speaking here completely as a layperson on this job.
Right.
You know, I have no psychological training at all, not in the least. It's only, you know, every once in a while I get interested in it, but nothing more than that. I never even took a course in college on it. I took one on psychiatry and Freud and psychology, but nothing beyond that. So my understanding is, just reading him, that there was a lot that he was always anxious about, even in his manic phase. And I think part of this, at least as I tried to explain in the book, and this is a guess more than it is anything else, you know, he in 1909 had what he considered a mystical vision in Rome, on Easter of all days. And while he was there in Rome, he thought that God had given him not only a vision of all times and all places, all cultures and all peoples in a moment, but he also thought that God had commanded him to record what he had seen in that moment. And there's no doubt that he did try to live up to that the rest of his life, but he always felt inadequate to the task. And as I see him, and there were other figures of his day who were like this. In fact, I think you just said the tortured artist is not just in the 20th century. I think it's in a lot of times. But he really felt like, you know, God, why did you ask me to do this? I'm trying my best, and I just can't keep up with it. Though he was a very faithful Catholic.
Yeah.
So, yeah, but that, you know, just like Mother Teresa, those darknesses come in, I think.
Now, how does such a prominent man, then, as you describe in your book, Sanctifying the World, how does such a prominent man and well-known, very well-known, like Christopher Dawson, how does he disappear so easily? This is something I've often wondered, how somebody so prominent can disappear overnight. That is, if they're really as prominent as we think they were, then why such a fast fall from grace, so to speak, from at least from having a real readership and a real effect on people?
For me, John, and again, this is, I'm guessing here, I'm not an expert on the 1960s or in Vatican II, and I'm a practicing Catholic. I believe in Vatican II. So any criticism I give of it is done as someone within the faith, not as an outsider. But I think for so many people, especially in the English-speaking world, where Catholicism, you know, became, at least in the Mass, the language of the vernacular and so forth, I think there was a really just a huge sea change culturally. Ralph McInerney is, you know, also a very devout Catholic, now passed away, of course, wrote in What Went Wrong with Vatican II, that there were really serious cultural changes. And we see that all the time. We see it in church architecture. You know, I was born in 1967, and my wife and I always joke, you know, the only thing that you have to fear about 1967 is church architecture. You know, I like the music from the period, but you know, you just look at all these, you know, what we kind of joke as Spaceship Marys.
The washing machines, and they look like washing machines, some of them as well.
Yeah, I hadn't heard that one. That's very good. And I think that, those are the kinds of things that Dawson feared. Others did too. Tolkien, E.I. Watkin, a number of prominent Catholics at the time feared this. But you really can trace, and Joseph Pierce has done this, Michael Novak, of all people, has done this, kind of traced how between about 1962 and 1972, almost every prominent Catholic from the interwar period to the postwar period just kind of disappears. Maritain has a drop in the respect that's given to him. Etienne Gilson does as well. Chesterton, Belloc, of course. Belloc's still in many ways recovering, and he's still kind of a niche figure within Catholicism. So all of these guys, Romano Guardini, I think only really came back with Pope Benedict. There have been some stragglers, people who kind of kept him up. But there's still figures. You think about Max Picard or Gabriel Marcel, people who were so huge in the 50s that we, even you and I who study this, we barely remember these guys.
Right.
And I think there was just a massive change that basically said, Vatican II is undo, and again, not the documents, not the council, but the culture that accompanies Vatican II basically says, we're starting anew here. And so many of these guys who actually laid the foundation for Vatican II also have what they considered outmoded views, and they just kind of got washed away in that movement towards new music, new architecture, everything.
It's such an oddity to me that I try to think of other eras in history where there was such a clean break with the past. And but in retrospect, as I think now, and as we talk about with Pope Benedict really reinforcing this idea that we don't use a hermeneutic of discontinuity or rupture with Vatican II,
right.
And you're kind of setting, I think, Catholics and others really straight on how to interpret Vatican II. In retrospect, we're only talking about 40 years or so, and that's really just kind of a blip in the long stream of history and Christian history.
Absolutely. And I'm with you on that completely, John. Absolutely. And, of course, Benedict, so much of what he did as Ratzinger was to make sure that Vatican II was interpreted as communio, or as a whole, not as no proof texting.
Well, this is John Pinero, and you're listening to Faith and Reason on Holy Family Radio, Grand Rapids, Kalamazoo. We're speaking with Dr. Brad Berzer, author of, among other works, Sanctifying the World, The Augustinian Life and Mind of Christopher Dawson. We've been talking about the person of Christopher Dawson, that is his upbringing, his personal history, his biography. Before we move on to what was actually in his writings about religion and culture, I wanted to ask one more question about his time at Harvard, if I may. I was told by a colleague of mine who recently had written a book on John F. Kennedy, this colleague of mine, Jason Duncan, that Kennedy was somewhat instrumental as a senator at the time of getting Dawson a visa and helping to arrange all this. Are you familiar with that story?
I am. I know it, and I hope I'm not going to get him in trouble.
Well, that's why I shouldn't have named him if it's apocryphal.
Grand Rapidite leaves Whitney, mm-hmm. who is the head of the Hauenstein Center at Grand Valley, mm-hmm. and he used to joke about that. It's like, well, whatever else we think about Kennedy, we can always at least thank him for making sure Dawson got into the country.
So that's not an apocryphal story then?
I'm sorry, John, I didn't catch that.
That's not an apocryphal story about Kennedy
Actually, okay. And I had relied on Gleese's version, which is correct, but yes, I was able to verify that.
Oh, good.
And there's no doubt that his visa was being held up a long time because he had tested positive for tuberculosis, but he was just a carrier of whatever signal there is that shows you have it. He did not actually have it, and he was not contagious, but he had some oddity, and it was finally Kennedy who put the call through the State Department and expedited. But Dawson was probably 3 or 4 weeks late for the semester by the time he started in the fall of 1958 because of that.
Wow. Well, if you have an endowed chair, maybe you can do that sort of thing. I don't know. Maybe
it's
you
not
do.
Bad if your senator's a Catholic, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
At least a quasi-Catholic.
Well, Dawson wrote it in various places, and you mentioned this in your book quite a bit, that if we want to understand history, we have to understand religion. That religion is the key to history, I think he said. And also the, in, to understand history and civilization, we have to understand culture. And maybe you could unpack what Dawson's theories were on the relationship of religion to culture first off, because I think Dawson was fairer than almost anyone else I can think of to giving very sympathetic and informed readings of paganism, of Hinduism, of all sorts of religions. But that connection between religion and culture, and then we'll move on to Christianity and Western European culture.
Yeah, it's a great question, John. Of course, it's so central to Dawson's own understanding. He was, you know, as we've already talked, he was a very serious Roman Catholic, a convert in late 1913, early 1914, and a convert for very good reasons, some personal reasons, but also very good intellectual reasons as well. But despite that, he was very open to all religions of the world, not in the sense that he thought they were all equal, but he thought they were all important. And his argument was that, you know, unless we understand the cult, the cultus, the root of culture, unless we understand what a people consider greater than themselves, that we will never understand them. And his argument was, and especially when people said, well, come on, you know, this, obviously we live in a day and age where religion is on the decline, and yet we still have these great advancements. And Dawson never discounted that. His argument was essentially that, yes, but we are the oddities. If you look at the entire history of the world, we have absolutely not one case of a pre-modern civilization that did not have some kind of divine. And that divine, it may have been Jupiter or Odin, or it may have been a grove of trees. But whatever it was, the human person and human culture has always considered something greater than itself as the root of the development of its own community. So Dawson said, you know, unless we understand that, we're not going to understand a people. And so his first book, which I think is just an intellectual tour de force, is The Age of the Gods. And in that, he argues essentially that we can look at all these cultures, some high, some low, some really developed, some extremely primitive, but every one of them has some kind of creation story, or at least an introduction story. Like the Sioux Indians don't believe in creation. They just believe that, you know, the white buffalo woman appeared and gave the laws to the people, but she was already there. So in some way, there's always an introduction story. And that story, you know, right or wrong, true or not, completely clouded in symbol or literal, that story, it indicated strongly who and what we were as a people and what any people considered important. So to look at history is always to look at religion, and not just religion. Yeah, he said if we only look at the religion, that's ridiculous as well. We have to look at environment, for example. You know, people who develop on the northern Great Plains in North America are going to develop naturally very different than the people who develop in the jungles of Central Africa, or, you know, in the mountains of Central Europe, because there are environmental conditions. And as an incarnational people, as Catholics, we have to recognize that both spirit and matter is important.
How then do we get from looking at that to not saying that the Christian religion and Catholicism in particular is not also conditioned in some way by environment, by geography, just by happenstance?
Yeah, I don't think Dawson would disagree with that. I think he would say, yes, of course, there, if we go up to Ireland, Christianity is going to be practiced in one way, but if we go to northern Iraq, God bless the people there who are obviously not doing well right now, the Christians, or anybody actually, but you know, when we go there, they're going to practice in a different way. And Dawson was very Augustinian in this, in the argument that it's more important that we agree on universals than we agree on particulars. Particulars are cultural manifestations of universal truths. And so as long as we agree to the same universal, we agree to the Trinitarian God or our notion of what the Trinity is, the creed, then how we go about worshiping that God is much less important. So it would makes sense that when you encounter a people who believe that you need to holler and shout when you talk to your gods or God, that's probably what they're going to do, and that's a cultural manifestation that may be distasteful, but it's not incorrect. So it would make sense that certain peoples, the Eskimos, for the Inuit, for example, will have their own understanding of God. He will probably be a god of snow, and as opposed to someone who is in the central region of Brazil, who has no concept of what snow is. Still the same god, maybe, right? It's Christian or some universal belief, but very different ways of thinking about that god.
Is it the subtitle or the main title of your book, Sanctifying the World, is something Dawson talked about then, that these cultures then, through immersion in the Christian story, are sanctified, that this doesn't just happen with individuals, but that it happens with cultures. Can you talk a little bit about sanctification and this process? How do we take pagan Europe, particularly pagan Rome, just a very violent, ugly place, entertained by mass bloodletting of both human and beast. How do we go from that to the 1,000 years later, the Europe of Thomas Aquinas and Dante and Saint Francis? How does this happen? What's the process?
Yeah, such a hard question, John. It's such a great one. This, for Dawson, this is central to his whole understanding of the world, and I think we could say here that Dawson is probably in this belief, like so many other Christian humanists of the 20th century, he is extremely stoic. And there is a pagan longing for the kind of natural law, universal mind that exists, that there's something that's much older than Christianity, but that Christianity taps into, especially St. Paul and St. John in their own writings. And it's this belief that, and it goes back to communio that we were talking about earlier, that everything is linked to the whole in some way. That there's nothing that's not a part of the whole. There's nothing that's not a part of the body of Christ. Even in its most wretched form, evil, of course, for someone like Dawson, is a corruption. It's not a thing in and of itself. It's a corruption of the good. So even within pagan cultures, the interpretation of maybe something that leads to mass sacrifice or violence, and not voluntary sacrifice, but actual killing of children and innocents and so forth, that even these probably had some root in truth, that truth being that sacrifice was good, but they had taken it in a very different direction. So you get people like Dawson arguing this, Lewis, yes, Lewis argued it, J.R.R. Tolkien, a number of figures, and they really are trying to pull together a universal whole. How do we go back to the Logos? How do we go back to the Incarnation? What does that mean for each culture? And I often, when I'm talking with my students, and as you know, here at Hillsdale, we're pretty, in a good way, I think we've got a little divided Christendom here, but a happily divided Christendom. We've got almost an equal number of Reformed and Evangelical students, Protestants, as we do Catholics. And I think it's interesting to talk to them about this because Catholics generally are much more open to pagan ideas and pagan philosophies than Protestants are. And that's actually one of the great Protestant criticisms of Catholicism, of course, is that we are pagan and we do have images and adultery and so forth. But I think there's an interesting argument to be made on the Catholic side that, well, if God is a part of this creation, we can't just undo all of it. So if we encounter a people who has never heard of any form of Judaism or Christianity, it's not necessarily their fault, and we shouldn't blame them and say they're of Satan. In fact, we should say, all right, they're probably and certainly of God, but they messed something up somewhere, and so we have to figure out where this is the case. It's part of the duty of every good Christian, every good evangelist going into a new culture or community. So this is really cheesy, John, and I hope this doesn't just make you cringe, but I think it's one way that I can help explain this, especially to my Protestant students. I just always say, look, the idea is when you encounter a pagan culture, you don't throw the baby out with the bathwater, you use the bathwater to baptize the baby. So, obviously those who don't believe in infant baptism get kind of worked up about that, but I think they get the point that when we encounter something, we have to take it seriously. and you know, this is, I'm not sure when this show is going to air, John, but you know, here we are talking on a Wednesday, and you know, technically this is the day that people are to worship Odin. That's what Wednesday means as we're recording this. And of course, neither you nor I are offended by that. And we're not going to go out and try and change the day and make it say St. Veronica Day. We're not radicals about this. And that's exactly the kind of thing Dawson was interested in. It's like, all right, what do we do with this? Here's a place. Here's Assisi. Here's a place that has been dedicated to this Roman god forever. And what's the Catholic Church do when it gets there? It doesn't tear down the Roman temple. Literally doesn't tear it down. It leaves the structure in Assisi of the Roman temple, and it bells around it. Yeah, so what an amazing visual to walk up to that in Assisi and to see here's a Roman temple, all still there, columns, everything, and yet around it is this beautiful cathedral. I can't remember which right now, but there it is. And that's a stunning thing, and we do that. Easter falls, you're absolutely on a pagan holiday. Christmas, pagan holiday. And we've baptized it to a certain extent. And that, Dawson believed that it wasn't enough, you know, I mean, it is theologically to go out and baptize in the name of the Father, Son, and the Holy Ghost. But you also have to take that seriously. Baptism doesn't mean destruction. It means taking what's there and pointing it in the right direction. And so when we baptize a baby, we don't remake the baby. Baby's already there. But the baby's soul is redirected towards the good, towards God. And that's exactly what Dawson said we have to do with pagan culture. Now, there's some things we can't undo. So we get to the Aztecs, and they're sacrificing 1,000 people a day. Well, there's nothing we can do to make that good. That has to stop. So there is an element of prudence here as well. But in general, many pagan things can be baptized. Does that make sense, John?
Yes, that makes a lot of sense. And so that's a very slow process. So you could be Charlemagne, and you could march a few thousand Saxons through a river and call it baptism, but it's going to take a while for a Christian culture to take root among them, right?
Yes. Okay. Right, and I love, you know, just in America, the example of, you know, when you get great Protestant missionaries like the Whitmans, and of course their idea is that you take your time with one individual Indian and you teach them the faith and you go through all of this, and then you get someone like a Jesuit, like Father de Smet, you know, who on record, I think, baptized something like 2,000 Northern Plains Indians in one morning. there's a difference there, definitely, and I think, you know, for Dismet, it's like, well, let's get these people in, and then, you know, we'll let grace work, and then we'll work more on their children than this.
Well, and that's, I think that's the conversion process with all of us in the sense of an ongoing conversion process. We're not the, you know, the moment of confirmation if we're
that's
a
right.
cradle Catholics, or the moment we enter the church at an Easter vigil. We don't have, I would say, full understanding even of a lot of the central truths of the faith. I know my wife is a convert, and it took her many, many years to come to an agreeable understanding as a former evangelical of things like our Catholic teaching on Our Lady or the saints, certain other things. You know, that takes time.
So well put, John. That's beautifully put. And, of course, you know, for us as Catholics, time is not moment by moment. It's the whole of existence outside of eternity.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for a lot of Protestants, they tend to think moment by moment, right? My dad was saved at this tent meeting and at this time, and they celebrate it that way. And we have a much more... It's a much more tenuous, much more progressive process, not progressive in the bad sense, but in the sense that it takes a while.
So we've talked about the pagans here. Let's keep talking about Protestants, and I'll ask this question, which I think our listeners will be interested in as well as I, and that is, what then was Dawson's opinion of Protestants? I know that he had I know that he identified much of the Reformation with nationalist movements as opposed to a universal Christendom or the universality, the Catholicity of the Christian faith. But beyond that, what could you tell us?
Yeah, really two things, John. The first thing is, when it came to the Reformation itself as an actual historical moment or era, Dawson, I mean, he was controversial on this. He actually, exactly what we were just talking about, he thought that Luther and Calvin probably did have an argument to make that Catholics had not sanctified enough. That is, they had allowed too many paganisms to remain too pagan. And Dawson was quite critical of that. He was explicitly, he didn't write about it a lot, but when he did, he thought, you know, we could make an argument that there's something that, if you're a Protestant, you could say how Catholics had allowed this idolization to continue, maybe too readily. And Dawson got into some trouble even with the Catholic Church for that. But in the Protestant moment, or in the moment of the Reformation, Dawson really despised Martin Luther. And of course, here we are recording today. This is the 484th anniversary of the Augsburg Confession today. So kind of a nice little irony there. But he really liked Calvin. And I think part of it, you know, he liked Melanchthon too within Lutheranism. And I think for someone like Dawson, I think it was the universal idea of the liberal arts that Calvin believed in. You know, Calvin's first book was on Seneca, and Melanchthon, obviously very great liberal arts scholar. I think for him, the fact that they had maintained their universal appreciation of the liberal arts allowed them to kind of transcend the narrow sectarian or nationalist views that someone like Luther had. So that, I think, was important for Dawson. Plus, we have to remember at the time that Dawson was writing, it was generally accepted by almost everyone outside of the most hardcore Lutherans that Martin Luther was really the foreshadowing of Hitler. And I mean, that sounds even weird to say now, but certainly coming out of World War II, and where do we find German nationalism? How do we identify with this? A lot of people turned to Luther as the root of that. Even, you know, someone like Jacques Barzun, who I think is a very, very overall, a very ecumenical man and very tolerant of a lot of things, on his book on Dawn to Decadence, said quite clearly that he saw Luther as the beginning of all modern ideology and of all horrors in the modern world. And that's, whatever you think of Luther, that's a lot to put on one man in all kinds of ways. But the second thing that Dawson thought, and I think this is important about the Reformation, is it's one thing to be critical of Luther. It's a very, very different thing to be critical of Lutherans today. And so his argument was, you know, of course Lutherans today are going to believe this and that. This is what they've been raised. They're now, we're 400 years into Lutheranism. And so it's one thing to condemn a Luther, which may or may not be acceptable. It's totally different to condemn a modern day Lutheran. And so Dawson didn't like divided Christendom, but he also believed that it was just something that we have to accept in the modern day, and that really Catholics and Protestants probably at this point in history had a lot to learn from one another. So he of all the people of his era, he was very, very ecumenical and open, one of the least, I hesitate to even use terms like this, John, but he certainly was one of the least bigoted people of his day on any side of the question, because I think he really did believe, and kind of the way Lewis did, that there is a mere Christianity, even though he was also strongly Roman Catholic.
It sounds to me like not only in Dawson's approach to Protestant Christians, but also to pagan cultures and what liturgists and others will call acculturation when it comes to the way the faith might be expressed, the way Mass might be observed around the world in Africa and the Caribbean in a suburban parish. Maybe we don't want to go there, a suburban U.S. parish, but but in other places, that there's going to be differences there. And the Africans might take 3 hours for Mass and have a lot of dancing and singing, as my Nigerian friends tell me. And
yeah.
And you know, it's hard to find a massive Baroque gilded structure in the Dominican Republic, but I've been in churches there with dirt floors and no windows, and I'm pretty sure it's the Mass. And so it sounds like Dawson prefigured that Vatican II approach of looking for what's well and good in other religions and approaching Protestant Christians in maybe a different way. Looking at the unity first. Is that fair to say? Because earlier you said, well, that he doesn't, you know, in some ways Vatican II was the outcome of Vatican II not in the documents was also kind of a problematic.
Yes, absolutely, John. And again, I think that's so well stated. Yeah, this is Dawson trying to put the emphasis on what we hold in common as opposed to what we differ on. And that was just as true for Protestants as it was for anyone. And Dawson, you know, for his day and age, in fact, for any day and age, is just reading through his letters. And I know you know this as well, but I don't think the man had an intolerant bone in his body when he came to anything dealing with race or ethnicity. You know, he, in that sense, he was truly Catholic, universal, and I think just wonderful. And that does. Yeah, I'm sure you had the same thing, John, but one of the things I credit so much with my upbringing, and I'm born 67, so I'm after Vatican II, and I never saw anything before that. But one of the things I learned and was drilled into me from not only my mother, but my Dominican nuns that I had in grade school, yes, everybody's made in the image of God. That's just a fact, right? It's like, right. It doesn't matter what you look like or the accidents of your birth. And I think Dawson really had that in him. Part of that's that Stoic element, but part of it is just that deeply held Catholicism. So let's look what we have in common, not what we have in difference.
Well, it sounds like he faced bigotry firsthand in his own family as a convert. Is that right?
That's right. He did, and his mother never forgave him for converting. That's not as much anti-Catholic, I think, on her part as it is, you've disowned our family, which has been Anglican clergy for so long.
I see.
And, I think she took it more as a renouncing of their tradition than necessarily an embracing of another tradition.
This is John
Pinner. That makes sense.
Yes, it does. Thank you. This is John Pinero, and you're listening to Faith and Reason here on Holy Family Radio, Grand Rapids, Kalamazoo. We're talking with Bradley Berzer, author of, among other books, Sanctifying the World, The Augustinian Life and Mind of Christopher Dawson. You mentioned earlier, Brad, about the days of the week, and you mentioned Wednesday, and of course there's other days of the week that have pagan origins. And something I just wanted to go back to it briefly, because it occurred to me while you were saying the Christians did not change the days of the week, although we number them at seven, but the secularist radical Jacobins did. They wanted a very logical 10-day week during the French Revolution. These are the Jacobins, of course, responsible for the Reign of Terror and the bloodletting, but just some real just zaniness makes it sound too nice during that time period. But changing the 10-day weeks, because this seems more logical. The metric system, the whole ball of wax there, which leads me to ask, you've talked about these Christian humanists, and many of our listeners maybe will have heard of humanism and think of secular humanism, but in your book, you wrote a very interesting sentence, talking about Dawson, of course, saying, it's an oxymoron to use a term like secular culture. If cult is at the root of culture, then you can't really have a secular culture. But these folks clearly have a non-neutral ideology that they would like to foist on the rest of us, and part of the consequences of that would be a crushing of Christian culture. It would have to be, and I wonder if you might comment on what Dawson might teach us then about the dangers of ideology and this thing we call secularism.
Yeah, absolutely, John. Of course, he was horrified by the French Revolution, and that was one of the things that preoccupied him, as it did people he respected, like Edmund Burke and Alexis de Tocqueville. He was absolutely horrified by what had been introduced with the French Revolution, and for that, he looked back to Burke, I think probably more than anyone else, to understand how radical the Jacobins really were. And of course, we, getting back to the days of the week, as you just mentioned, we still have a seven-day week, of course, but we've also sanctified it. So it may still be Wednesday, but it's also a feast day. And so we still call it Wednesday, but it's also the feast of it. I'm sorry, I don't know what today's feast day is, but I'm sure my grandparents would have known. I should know.
Yesterday was the feast of the Nativity.
We have a liturgical calendar that goes next to or on top of what we have. So we do have this repetitive cycle that both is in our secular lives, but as well as in our religious lives. So the whole thing, every saint really is pointing towards grace and a way to escape the cycles of nature. What the French attempted to do, and then, of course, their followers, I don't think anyone probably more radical than the Cambodians in the 20th century under the Khmer Rouge, but their idea of recreating everything according to logic or reason or the goddess reason, they never really escape religion. They just make their own up in the way that they approach it. But the very fact that they start over at year zero or year one, or that they try and change those names and dates, is really indicative of how utterly radical they were. And trying to remake the world in their own image, not in the image of the humane or of the godly, but of the human. And that, I think, when you're asking about something like humanism, and we look at the humanism of, in this country, a Paul Elmer Moore, one of the great scholars out of Princeton in the early part of the 20th century, or T.S. Eliot, one of his good friends, or, you know, a number of other figures, Sister Matileva at St. Mary's University, so many figures that we can look back to, Russell Kirk. Their humanism was not the humanism of the French, which really was about the human. They were really humane, and they believed in the humanities, and they believed in being humane. And so the Christian humanists of the 20th century argued essentially that in order to understand the human person, we must understand what's above and below. Right? It's a sense of justice. We need to know what to give to each person, what is his or her due in the classical sense of justice. So they were really concerned about what is humane as opposed to what's human. What's human was a part of things, but it wasn't the end-all, be-all. So lower than the angels, higher than the animals, mm-hmm. but not in the sense that, you know, in the same way the angels don't rule over us and exploit us. We don't do the same thing to animals. We care for them, and we have stewardship and dominion as opposed to exploitation and tyrannical control. So Dawson, I think, in his understanding of humanism, the critique that he would give of how a corporation might treat nature was on the same wavelength as how the French ideologues might treat the human person, though, of course, one is, you know, much more detrimental. But if we don't act as a steward, if we don't act as bearing the image of Christ, then we're not being humane in any way. And that, of course, Dawson got in trouble with this, but it, like many others, C.S. Lewis as well, they argued that there was absolutely no such thing as left-right. That was purely a trick by the ideologues to get us distracted. Yeah, the only real division is man, anti-man, Christ, anti-Christ.
So we have to go deeper than those secondary elements that grow out of culture. We have to go
exactly.
Deeper than politics, deeper than economics. You mentioned Eliot and Lewis a lot. So you would argue then, and you do, I think, that the way to conceptualize all these important Christian individuals of the 20th century, whether we're diverse individuals, Solzhenitsyn, Eliot, Tolkien, Lewis, we would put them under this broader heading then of Christian humanism as people trying to sanctify their age, save it.
It's a term I like. It's a term that I was introduced to when I was an undergrad at Notre Dame. I had not encountered it before. And then really through my interaction with people like Winston Elliott in Texas and Gleaves Whitney in Grand Rapids, that's really where I got interested in the ideas of Christian humanism. Many of them would have called themselves that. That's how Dawson identified himself. Certainly Lewis, off and on, would identify that way. Thomas Merton did. Flannery O'Connor did. In fact, if you ever get a chance to look at O'Connor's book on just the editorials she wrote during her lifetime. Yeah, she deals with Kirk and Dawson and so forth, and those is just a beautiful look at Christian humanism. But there were great divisions among them, too. So yeah, looking back now, I think we could put very diverse people like the Hungarian Aurel Kolnai, the Frenchman Jacques Maritain, the Russian Nicholas Berdyaev, but they had real differences with one another. So yeah, Dawson really didn't want to be in the same camp as Maritain, but Maritain had no problem being in the same camp with Dawson. I think at the time they often struggled with each other, but they did so looking back in hindsight more as brothers and fellow travelers than they did as enemies.
And those kind of struggles can be very fruitful for the rest of us.
Absolutely.
And for the faith, sure.
You know, I mean, I think about the almost absolute hatred that Lewis had for Eliot, and yet out of that, there are some really interesting things that arise. And I would never advocate hatred. And Lewis really was over the top, I think, when it came to Eliot. But, it prompted him to write certain things, to deal with certain things, to try and answer certain things that had Eliot not existed, Lewis probably wouldn't have challenged or encountered or thought of.
Yeah. Challenging individuals do that. Pope Francis commenting on economics is a great challenge. To some Catholics trying to, understand what exactly he might mean and whether it differs from what they already think, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, our whole tradition, John, is one of the things I love about Catholicism. It's not wishy-washy, but it's very nuanced. And I think Catholicism is willing to say, hey, there are things we do not know. We just don't know. We may never know. And I think that this is so much a part of the 21st century, and it doesn't matter if we're talking about politics or economics. So many people want absolute surety. And that is just, the Catholic tradition is we have hope and we have faith, but there are lots of things we just don't know, and there's a mystery, and mystery's not bad.
The words of St. Paul always they've affected me for many years, where he writes about working out our salvation in fear and trembling, and I think that's very different than working it out with the kind of absolute assuredness of my salvation due to a particular point in time where I said a few words and committed myself to Jesus. But there's some fear and trembling that comes along with the ride.
I agree completely. I understand the desire to know that, but it also, it kind of renders the whole virtue of faith and hope, both virtues, as obsolete. If you have absolute assuredness, you really don't have faith anymore. You have fact. So,
well, if you just a couple more things in our closing minutes here.
Oh, John, this is great.
Yeah, I'm talking with Brad Berzer. This is Faith and Reason on Holy Family Radio. For folks in our listening audience who were unfamiliar with Dawson or who have heard bits and pieces about Dawson before, what should they, once they're done reading your book, right? And so they have this great introduction, which you provide. Where should they go first in among Dawson's works? Where would be a good place to start? And then maybe a little bit more challenging book.
I don't want to be falsely humble here at all. That book I wrote on Dawson was a work of just pure love. I first encountered Dawson by picking up, talking to Gleaves Whitney, but then finding in a used bookstore in Fort Wayne his 1942 book, The Judgment of Nations, and it just, it was a mind-boggling experience for me, just having come right out of grad school and being so indoctrinated in narrowness and moving away from the liberal arts, and just opened my mind to so many things. So I would really, as proud as I am of the book I wrote, I would encourage anyone out there that they should really start with Dawson rather than me, because Dawson is such a great writer, and he's not hard in the sense that you just have to spend hours and hours on him. The Judgment of the Nations is available, and that, because of Catholic University Press, that is probably where I'd start for anybody, because it deals with World War II, and it's something that a lot of people in the public will have a common understanding and background for. So that's where I would go with that. After that, there really, anything that Dawson published, I think, which again is now almost all of it's coming back through Catholic University, a little bit from Ignatius Press as well, but anything there is just great. The Formation of Christendom, which you can get from Ignatius, and The Division of Christendom, both very, very well written, beautifully executed books. So that's what I'd start with. Gerald Rosello's book, the edited book he did on Dawson a few years ago, which I think is still available, also very good. So I would start with Dawson, John, and I'm not trying to stop my own book sales. I'm happy to have that book sell, but really Dawson is where anyone should start. They just go straight to the source with him.
Right. Here's to make it more difficult for you to be humble. Let me tell you this about your book.
I'll go to confession later.
Yeah. I'm going to complicate your life now. Dawson believed that if we really wanted to get to the root of what was wrong with the modern culture, we had to realize that we once had a Christian culture, and then determine the degree to which it was still Christian, and then hope that we could rise again in a kind of birth, death, and resurrection sequence that he had drawn history into these great ages of the church. And so in 2007, 2008, when I was working to create the Catholic Studies program at Aquinas College here in Grand Rapids, I was, I was looking at programs around the country, and some of them only emphasized the intellectual history of the church. And I thought, I think we need more than that. I wanted to go, I was a devotee of Russell Kirk's works and others, so I wanted to, go towards culture. I was trying to think of a way to do that, and I read your book, and in your book, That was my introduction in a very specific way to Dawson's program for the study of Christian culture. And he just kind of, he laid out the curriculum, and it might not be perfect, but I thought this is it. And that's largely what we do at Aquinas College in the Catholic Studies program. I mean, our approach to Christian culture is very Dawsonian in that sense, down to having philosophy in the curriculum and history and literature and looking at the arts and culture produced by a Christian people and seeing what we can tell, the difference between an artist who happens to be Catholic and a Catholic artist, for instance. And I think your book in some ways was really instrumental in that. So thank you very much.
Oh, thanks, John. And of course, the reputation that you guys have is just fantastic, and what you've done with Catholic studies, it's great. Absolutely. And Dawson, as you know, Dawson did not want to follow Adler, Mortimer Adler, down the road of a great books program. He loved the great books, but he really did believe, if John is running this Catholic studies program, it has to reflect the personality of John. It can't just be another Adler program.
To the horror of some people at Aquinas.
Gosh, I would pick Adler over almost anyone in academia today.
Yeah.
But I understand the point. It's like, okay, let's not crush personality in doing this.
Yeah.
So great books are great, but they also, if they don't reflect you as the leader and creator of this program, well, they're going to fail as well.
And
so
I think personality
matters.
Yeah, Will Helmson had some good critiques, I think, of great books programs that I find compelling. I mean, they're good, and they're better than
Absolutely.
A lot of alternatives, but there is that danger without something overarching like Catholic theology that they slip into a type of relativism. I didn't want to let the show go without asking you about your book on a man whom you've mentioned several times on this show, and that is Russell Kirk. I have been working on an intellectual biography, I think we might call it, of Russell Kirk for a few years now, and I understand that it's getting very close to publication. What's the status on that?
Oh, thanks, John, for asking. It's been another labor of love. It's very much like the Dawson book in my mind. Kirk was one of those figures, again, who was so prominent in his day and age, and I think because of the splits in the post-Reagan right over the last 20 years. Of course, Kirk died 20 years ago in April, so this is the 20th anniversary of his death. I think there's time to revive who and what he was, and I think he offers a kind of vision of a strong America without being an imperialist America, and I think a very humane America. As you know, John, he converted, though it took him a very long time. He converted to Catholicism in 1964, and he had been struggling with that for almost 20 years up to that point. So he was 45, just right on the edge of turning 46, my age right now, when he converted and got married, and his life really changed. But that book covers his life, the book I'm writing, covers his life from 1918 up until his death in 1994, and then really what's the legacy and what does he have to offer. And I am most concerned with his Christian humanism. That is what I'm really looking at, and how he viewed the Christian Republic, a republic of letters. So I do get into some of the personal details, his marriage, his children, and so forth, and especially his friendships. Probably I deal with his friendships more than anything else, with people like T.S. Eliot, and they were almost best friends, really, towards the end of Eliot's life, very close. But that book has been great, and it's at the publisher right now. It's supposed to come out in the spring of next year, so just a little less than a year from now, it should be hitting the press. I've still got to make some revisions on it, but yeah, it's a roughly like 220,000 word book, so it's not small.
Yeah, that's
and,
a big one.
What a blessing that Annette Kirk opened all of the papers to me, his diaries, everything, unpublished writings, and it's overwhelming. The number of things he wrote, I don't get how he did it.
His private letters alone,
novels,
but the
short
columns,
stories, essays, books, just incredible.
His best book, in my opinion, is his book on Eliot. Do you have a...
I think that's probably the one that, and The Conservative Mind, will be remembered probably more than anything else. But my favorite book of his is his last novel, Lord of the Hollow Dark, which is a kind of a Catholic horror story and tries to tie in all kinds of ideas with Eliot's characters and bring a cohesion to Eliot's mythology. I love that book, but so many good things. So there's really nothing he wrote that's not good.
Well, this is Dr. John Pinero, and we've been spending time with Dr. Bradley Berzer, professor of history and Kirk Chair in American Studies at Hillsdale College. I want to thank you very much, Brad, for being on Faith and Reason today. It's been It's just been a real pleasure hearing about Christopher Dawson and all these other important folks from the 20th century.
Well, it's a great honor for me, John, and I'm so proud we're allies in this world together. So thanks for having me.
Okay, thank you very much, and good afternoon, listeners, and thank you for tuning in to Faith and Reason.
You've been listening to Faith and Reason with your host, Dr. John Pinheiro, on Holy Family Radio. If you'd like to listen to this program again or share it with a friend, audio copies are available online at holyfamilyradio.net. Dr. John Pinheiro is Professor of History and Director of Catholic Studies at Aquinas College in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Faith and Reason is brought to you by Holy Family Radio. I'm your program producer, Michael Fiorenzo. Join us next time as we connect the riches of the Catholic intellectual tradition to daily life. Thanks for listening.